From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. People living along the Florida Panhandle are rushing to prepare today for Hurricane Michael. The storm is expected to make landfall tomorrow as a major hurricane with wind speeds of at least 110 miles per hour. Jeff Huffman is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. He's in Gainesville, Florida. Hi, Jeff. It's good to have you back again today.
Oh, good afternoon, Peter. I wish it was better circumstances that we're talking, but good afternoon to you.
Yeah, and what are those circumstances? I know a lot has changed in the last 24 hours since we last
talked. It has. And let me get right to the point about something. This, you know, when we talk about hurricanes, and we've talked a lot about several in the last 2 or 3 years, we always prepare for what could be the reasonable worst case scenario. This one, more than Florence, I think potentially it could be a worst case scenario, or it could achieve that status for some locations in the panhandle of Florida. I say that with the most a straightforward tone in my voice as possible. This hurricane is continuing to strengthen. It could have winds of 125 miles per hour at landfall near Panama City or just to the east. And we're talking about potentially a catastrophic storm surge event in some of the coastline that's the most vulnerable in Florida to a storm surge, stretching all the way through Appalachia Bay, the Big Bend, and all the way over to the Nature Coast close to Cedar Key. So, Peter, I can't stress enough, you know, Harvey was an extreme event in terms of its rain. Florence was also an extreme event in terms of its rain. This one has the potential to also be an extreme event for wind as it comes ashore tomorrow.
Let's talk about that storm surge. You mentioned the geography of Florida and the Florida panhandle there. Locals call it the Big Bend area. What does the geography have to do with how bad that storm surge could be?
Well, two things are really working against are working to enhance the surge in that area. We've got shallow shelf waters. So think of a bathtub being pretty deep. It's pretty hard to you know splash water out of a bathtub because it's so deep. Mm-hmm. But then think of you know something that's a little more shallow where the water can easily move out of it. And these winds are going to push and drive that water miles inland in some areas. And then also the concavity of the coastline kind of acts as a funnel to funnel that water, especially up near the Big Bend region. So when you take that, even if the storm wobbles and maybe moves further to the west, I spoke earlier, just a few minutes ago, actually, to the National Hurricane Center specialist there, and he confirmed with me that it doesn't really matter at this point how close the center comes to cities like Apalachicola, Point St. Joe, over toward the Steinhatchee, and even Cedar Key. No, the track really no longer matters. This is a significant and life-threatening storm surge for those areas.
And it's not just Florida. The entire state of Alabama is under an emergency declaration. And this storm could eventually track over the Carolinas, which of course are still cleaning up after Hurricane Florence. So what are you watching for outside of the Florida Panhandle?
Well, we just touched base with our partners in South Carolina because we provide weather coverage for them as well, and they're preparing for some flooding from this. The storm's going to be moving at a fast enough pace, but any water right now in eastern portions of South Carolina and southern portions of North Carolina is bad news. It's going to take some time to assess how this will affect river levels over time, but that's the big concern there. And Peter, this will become what we call a nor'easter almost. It's going to become a very strong extra-tropical low or post-tropical low, and really it'll have some wind and water impacts all the way up into the mid-Atlantic states.
Briefly, we were just speaking to you, it seems, about Hurricane Florence when that hit the Carolinas. How's the 2018 hurricane season shaping up? More active than usual?
Well, it was forecast to be near or slightly below active. These are two great examples that it really doesn't matter how active the entire basin is. All that matters is where a storm goes. And unfortunately, we're looking at our second hurricane landfall here this season in the southeast United States.
Okay. Jeff Huffman, director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, thanks as always.
All right. Thank you, Peter.
Experts around the world say storms are becoming more severe as the Earth is becoming warmer. And our next guest has been determining what this means for the economy. William Nordhaus is an economist at Yale University. Yesterday, he was one of two winners of the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics. And he's a proponent of the idea of putting a tax on carbon emissions. Under the carbon tax, maybe your gasoline or coal-generated electricity would cost more. Solar power would not. Professor Nordhaus says the way a carbon tax works is simple.
It's the idea that you put a price on carbon emissions the way you put a price on other things like oil or bread. And the idea is you put a price on it, then people will reduce their use of it.
Why do you think this approach has not been accepted and put into practice widely in the United States?
Well, first let me say the United States is the place that's been most resistant to it. It's in place in other countries. It's actually in place in China, in Canada, widespread in Europe. China is extending it from a few of its cities to a nationwide program. So it's mainly the United States which is resisting.
How is it working in those other countries that you mentioned?
Well, the one that I particularly admire is British Columbia. It's a carbon tax, but it's also one that returns the revenues to the residents of British Columbia. So it's what's called a revenue neutral or recycled carbon tax. So what happens is it raises the price of carbon products. It's collected, but then it's rebated. And I think that's particularly attractive because then people see, oh, the government is not taking it and using it for whatever purposes it wants, but it's basically using the tax to penalize carbon products, but then giving people the revenue back so their actual real incomes in inflation-protected terms don't go down.
Well, you have had for many, many years now a huge megaphone in terms of your teaching, in terms of your international work. And right now you have a larger megaphone because you just won a Nobel Prize. So if you were to talk to decision makers, which I think you are right now, in the United States, what's the best argument to adopt a carbon tax system here?
Well, I would want to broaden it out, actually. I would say we need to explain why we have problem with climate, why we have a problem with climate change, why it's so dangerous, and why we need to do something about it. We need to clear away all the rhetoric. So that's the first thing.
Do you think that is really not known by now?
That's a good question. I think it's known by lots of people, but also it's denied by many people. And in particular, people, it's widely rejected in public, at least by the Republican Party. And I won't mention the president who claims it's a hoax. So we just need to, that's the first thing. A second thing we need to have incentives in place. And this is where the carbon tax or carbon pricing comes to penalize the use of carbon intensive products and encourage the use of low carbon products. But then the third point, we're going to need to develop the technologies to replace the current technologies we have in place. And that's a big job for scientists and engineers and for companies as well. So those are the three things I would emphasize: public understanding, incentives, and technology.
When President Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord last year, he cited the draconian financial and economic burdens the agreement imposes on our country, meaning the U.S. There are businesses that believe that environmental protection is just too costly. It is expensive. I mean, can you argue with that?
Well, I think if it is done in an efficient way, it's actually not that expensive. There are various estimates made by specialists, and the costs over 20 years would be something like 1 to 2% of income. So that's like 0.05 to 0.1% per year. And these are just the costs. This doesn't take into account the damage that we're reducing. So, for example, if you take steps to improve to slow climate change, you would lessen, say, coastal flooding, you would lessen sea level rise. And actually, our studies would suggest that the net impact would actually be positive rather than negative. So I think it's basically, there will be sectors that will be impacted. We talk about coal. It is true, coal would be impacted. But we're talking about relatively small parts of the economy compared to the large number of places that would be severely impacted.
One final question. It would seem after you win a Nobel Prize, you can rest on your laurels, so to speak. In your case, it may be just the opposite, do you think?
that's a good question. I don't really think it'll change my life that much, but I will plan to continue my teaching and my scholarship. And maybe with this endorsement, I can have more time to explain people that it's not hopeless, but we will have to take steps. But they're not very painful steps. They're steps we can take that will not radically change our lifestyle, but we have to take them. They may be radical ideas, but they won't radically change our lifestyle, and they won't really radically hurt us. They will, in the long run, help us.
Professor Nordhaus, thank you and congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful to have a chance to talk to you and your audience.
That's William Nordhaus, Nobel laureate at Yale University. And this note, the oil company ExxonMobil has donated $1 million to a group that advocates for a carbon tax. The group is called Americans for Carbon Dividends. It's co-chaired by former Republican Senator Trent Lott, and it wants a carbon tax in the U.S. with the money going back to consumers. Exxon reportedly wants the carbon tax because it's more certain than the option of a potential mix of regulations from state or local governments.
A work of fiction that went from the stage to the page is in bookstores today. Robin Young explains.
Dear Evan Hansen, we've been way too out of touch. Things have been crazy, and it sucks that we don't talk that much.
First, it was a musical, Dear Evan Hansen, the story of a socially awkward, woebegone high school senior who gets caught in a fib that spirals out of control about being the best friend of a classmate he actually hardly knew, who takes his life. And before you know it, our Dear Evan Hansen is leading a national movement against suicide. It was a huge hit when it debuted on Broadway in 2016.
On the outside, always looking in, will I ever be more than I've always been? Cause I'm tap, tap, tapping on the glass, waving through a window.
Dear Evan Hansen won 6 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. So besides a national tour, what could its creators, Benj Pasek and Justin Paul, music and lyrics, and book author Stephen Levinson, do for an encore? How about a young adult novel, which captivated this adult as well? Author Val Emick wrote the new Dear Evan Hansen book with input from the show's creators. And all four join us from the NPR studios in New York. Val Emick, you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Benj Pasek?
We are all here, yes.
Yes, Justin Paul.
Hello there.
Stephen Levinson.
Hello.
Benj, I understand that this is all based on something that happened in your high school?
It's not directly based on something that happened in my high school, but there was a student who I didn't know particularly well, and he passed away, and everyone in the school community, after his death, really began to sort of claim that they were closer with him than they actually were, myself included. And I was sort of struck by this, and when I met Justin in college, we began to talk about how similar phenomena like our generation's response to 9/11, we knew a lot of people who would insert themselves in this tragedy or pretend that they knew people that passed away and they might not have. And we were so captivated and curious by why our generation in particular feels the need to kind of publicly mourn and be a part of community by any means necessary. Yeah. And we wanted to explore that further.
Well, but in this case, Evan Hansen, he's a kid that just gets up every day trying to have a better day. In fact, he's in therapy, and part of his assignment in therapy has been to write a letter to himself, Dear Evan Hansen, you know, kind of telling himself about how he's going to have a good day. And what happens is that this young man, Connor, also a troubled classmate, but he presents as kind of a bully, he finds one of the letters, takes it home. After he kills himself, his parents think that it's a letter he's written to Evan Hansen, Dear Evan Hansen, and so they think they're best friends, and poor Evan Hansen kind of gets caught in this fib that spirals out of control and also kind of changes him. Stephen Levinson, this idea that he's suddenly finding respect from people and an entree into school life because there's this false idea about him, that's very compelling.
Yeah, well, I think he makes that decision ultimately to just kind of keep going with this story because everything he's always wanted comes true, but it's also that the people around him are healed by this story as well.
Right.
He feels as though he's giving something to them.
Yeah, the young man's family, they want to embrace this, you know, best friend of their son, who of course isn't. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. And it's also heartbreaking to hear Evan's mother, a struggling single mom, when she finds out Evan's been taken in by Connor's family, because she can't give him a lot of the things that they can. Let's listen.
And you say what you need to say so that you get to walk away. It would kill you to have to stay trapped when you've got something new. Well, I'm sorry I had it rough, and I'm sorry I'm not enough. Thank God they rescued.
Justin Paul, you were able to put those feelings into a song. What's it like now there's a YA novel? You don't have music to get across these characters.
No, it's true. It's something that we talked a lot about at the beginning of the process with Val, which was, you know, how do you take the what becomes sort of tentpole moments in the musical, how do you take that and translate it into a book?
Yeah.
It is an interesting process of how do you get inside a character's head in the same way that a song does. And that's why I think it does work so well as a novel, because the book allows us to get inside these characters' heads to really feel what they're feeling in the way that a song does. So I think it does translate well. And in the same token, we also felt like we wanted this to be a different experience from the musical. And so we weren't slavish to saying, okay, every time there's a huge song moment, we have to have a big moment in the book and we have to capture that huge thing, because we want this to be its own experience and to live on its own.
Val, any sweaty palms? This is very special to people. All these characters, and especially Evan Hansen, really mean something to young people. Then he's in your hands.
I'm glad I didn't speak to you before beginning the novel. yes, lots of sweaty hands. Still sweaty hands. In fact, it was the sweaty hands line in Evan's first monologue in the show that I was like, this is me. I can write this.
Because we should say, Evan also had sweaty hands.
That's right. He's trying to will his hands not to be sweaty, but by even thinking about them being sweaty, they're becoming more sweaty. I've been through that rabbit hole before.
Yeah.
I felt like I knew how to do this. Emotionally, I knew how to do it. At the same time, I did think it was sort of an unfair challenge, given the popularity and the intensity with which people had attached themselves to Evan and the other characters.
Well, talk more about this notion that you're writing about suicide. You had to, I'm imagining, be careful not to romanticize this.
For sure. Suicide is something that I have experience with, let's just say. I know the other guys have stories of their own. So I was definitely sensitive to that fact. But we all wanted to know more about Connor. The guys, definitely that was a goal of theirs and a mission they gave me. Tell us more about Connor. We have these ideas of him. Can you make these work? Okay, I think I can make some of this work. Really, it started with just finding his voice. At one point, they said, like, we want to give Connor some happiness. In the show, we're only seeing just this small glimpse of Connor, and it's torture. It's him taking his life. In the book, we get to know more about life before that. And part of his life, did he ever experience joy? Or was it all, you know, darkness?
We don't want to give anything away. But I have to say, we actually find out his backstory. And we find out this crushing thing that happened to him. You know, some people may not want to know that.
Yeah, this is Stephen.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely a tension that we felt in the creative process was, how much do we want to know? Obviously, you leave the show wanting to know more about Connor, but do you really want to know more about Connor, or do you want to imagine more about Connor? And I think what we found in the book, especially with Val's treatment of it, is that we learn many reasons why Connor goes the way he does and Evan goes the way he does. And it was important to us that it not feel monocausal, like there's this one thing that you know, is the reason Connor is the way he is or Connor does what he does. You know, and I think it's pretty successful in that.
It also feels like a cautionary tale for our times of what it's like to suddenly get swept up in media. Evan and his friends become a, you know, sensation. They're interviewed by everyone across the country. It's a cautionary tale, you know, what can happen when suddenly you don't even know what you're, you know, doing yet and you're on a national stage. There's that. But Benj Pasek and Justin Paul, I understand that while you debated what to do, how much to do more in a book than you did in the musical, your fans were already doing it. Fan fiction. They were writing about Evan and Connor and what might have happened.
Yeah, this is Justin. You know, that was something that was inspiring to us in terms of doing the novel adaptation was seeing that there were fans around the country, around the world, who had never seen the show. Maybe they had listened to the cast album or watched a clip online or something, and they were beginning to create their own stories with these characters and interactions that might have been between Evan and Connor. And
and a particular curiosity about Connor, which is, you know, partially what inspired us. Mm. People have wanted to engage with these characters, and that's what gave us the confidence to do this in the first place.
It is a conversation starter for families. You know, moms can see elements of their kids that their kids won't talk about, you know, out loud, and kids will see elements of their parents that humanize them. And ultimately, it's really about how we relate to our family members, how we hide ugly truths about ourselves.
Yeah, that part is the interesting thing, is because I think it's a given that people come and talk about, oh, this is like my family. But I think the more interesting and somewhat heartbreaking stories are the adults, the grown people who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s coming and saying, I'm Evan, or that was me, or that's how I still feel, or I'm still trying to become the most authentic version of myself, and I can't talk to people. I can't find community.
And of course, there's a burrowed teenager in all of us, but there's also the heartbreaking element of, I think, being a parent and not feeling like you know what you're doing, and you don't know how to save your kid, and you're doing the best that you can. Mm. And hopefully, when you see bits of the story that we don't necessarily talk about because they're taboo, depression or feeling inadequate or feeling like you want to be noticed or seen in a world where you feel incredibly isolated and alone, it gives permission to kind of talk about it and begin conversations that are really, really difficult. And that's why we found in the theater that there is kind of these cathartic moments that people are having together. And we hope that extends, and we're confident that it will, when people are reading the book. Mm-hmm. By reading that other characters are going through it, you realize that you're not the only one who's going through it. Yeah. And it can begin that conversation.
Yeah. We've been talking to Benj Pasek, Justin Paul, and Stephen Levinson, the creators of the musical Dear Evan Hansen. Val Emick wrote the new novel with them. It comes out today. Thanks to you all.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robin Young speaking to the authors of Dear Evan Hansen.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Google is the latest tech giant to fess up to a privacy breach this week. Reporting by the Wall Street Journal revealed that a bug gave outside developers access to 500,000 users' private data on Google's social network, Google+. The company decided not to disclose the breach when it first learned of it back in March. Instead, it said this week that it plans to shut down Google+ over the next 10 months. Callum Borchers is a senior innovation reporter at WBUR here in Boston. He joins me now in the studio. Callum, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Peter.
So this news about Google coming on the heels of Facebook's biggest hack ever, not a flattering moment for either of these companies, but what do we know about what's going on at Google?
No, and it's probably that Facebook backdrop that explains why they were so reluctant to disclose. But here's what we know that I think is so remarkable. Those internal documents obtained by the Wall Street Journal show that the private information in users' Google+ accounts was vulnerable between 2015 and March of this year. We're talking about a three-year span. That went undetected. So, and this personal information, we're talking about email addresses, birth dates, the places you've lived, occupations you've had, your relationship status, things like that.
It's been called a bug, not a hack, which is the same term they used during this Facebook event, I guess, for lack of a better word. Is that a PR spin? I mean, what's the difference between those two?
Well, so it was the bug that made the personal information vulnerable to hacking, but Google says that it has no evidence that the bug actually resulted in actual hacking. Mm-hmm. That's the big difference. It's sort of like if you'd left your wallet on the street and you came back to find it later and it was miraculously still intact, you would have said, oh, I left it exposed, but nothing bad actually happened. I don't think. I mean, you wouldn't know if somebody had maybe picked it up and written down your credit card number. And that's sort of the spot that Google is in right now. They don't know for sure.
So Google knew about this. And there was a memo that the Wall Street Journal obtained that said if Google had disclosed the breach when it first found out about it, it almost guaranteed that the CEO would be called before Congress. So it sounds like, and this does not sound good, that Google wanted to keep this very much quiet.
Right. Well, think about what happened when Mark Zuckerberg had to testify before Congress in April. He certainly didn't seem to enjoy that experience. In fact, I can remember this moment toward the end when one of the members of Congress said to him, hey, you know, we would take your suggestions about other tech CEOs we should hear from in a setting like this. And I sort of read the thought bubble above Zuckerberg's head as like, yeah, I'd love to see some of these other guys have to squirm in this chair. Nobody wants to get called before Congress.
Nobody wants to sit there. And it turns out nobody wanted to use Google Plus either.
Right. I mean, it's sort of a low-paying way for Google to be responsive to the problem. I mean, it doesn't hurt to shut down a service that really didn't have a lot of traction anyway. They've said that 90% of Google Plus sessions last less than 5 seconds. It's practically an accident when somebody clicks on a Google Plus account at this point.
It was supposed to be an answer to Facebook at the time. It did not work out. What other changes, if any, can we expect from the company?
Well, Google is saying it's going to give customers more power to control the individual bits and pieces of their account privacy. So, for example, in the past, when you've had an app request access to your Google account, it's been kind of an all or nothing proposition. Now you can grant partial access going forward. So maybe yes to viewing my calendar, no to looking at the documents on my Google Drive.
I see. Okay, Callum Borcher is a WBUR senior innovation reporter. Callum, thanks for coming in, as
always. Glad to be here.
The flood of refugees and migrants to Europe continues. More than 84,000 men, women, and children, mostly from Syria, Iraq, and Africa, have arrived in Spain, Italy, and Greece this year. Every day, more than 100 people arrive on the Greek island of Lesbos. The first faces they see are those of humanitarian aid workers who help them reach the shore, get clothing and food and health care and temporary shelter. Aid workers see trauma up close nearly every day for months, and that takes a toll. They have high levels of depression, exhaustion, and even PTSD that can last for years. Now the George Washington University Global Mental Health Program has drawn up a version of the Hippocratic Oath to address the problem. The ancient oath originated in Greece. It calls for new physicians to swear to abide by ethical standards. Philip Candilis is one of the doctors behind this new version.
It's still the general principles of caring for patients first, not doing mischief, knowing one's limits, keeping confidences that continue to this day.
Candilis is professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Science. He and his colleagues wrote the Hippocratic Oath for humanitarian workers based on what 19 aid agencies told them.
The way we turned it to humanitarian ideals was by basing it on the resilience training that we were doing. So we were eager that people take care of their team, take care of themselves, recognizing that there's a cascade of care that has to occur if people are going to take care of refugees. They have to take care of themselves first. They have to take care of their teams. They have to make sure that they stay within their areas of expertise. One of our colleagues at George Washington tells a story of when she was working in Africa. And as a psychiatrist, she was asked to do a cesarean section on a pregnant refugee. So the temptation to go beyond one's expertise is really difficult and desperate.
So you're saying that in this Hippocratic Oath, you're able to give her permission to say, I can't.
Right. That's exactly right. So defining the limits of one's expertise, what one can do safely without the resources that one needs, is one of the key principles of this work.
Do you think this is something that actually the humanitarian aid workers will really refer to, or is it just kind of nice to have the guideline there?
It's a great point. Our hope is that it can be kind of a unifying project for the folks that we work with. We've had it translated into Greek already. We're making a gift of it to the groups that we're going back to work with next month. So we're hoping it'll have some traction.
One of the things that you and your colleagues have noted is the potential culture clash as Muslim refugees, and they are mostly Muslim, enter a Christian region like the shores of Greece, a pretty homogenous white community. How has that caused problems, and how are you dealing with that?
We've been impressed that the people who work with the refugees have their own immigrant stories. So there's a shared experience, shared humanity that even those who are more Western or European generate, that they show when they're working with folks from North Africa and the Middle East. So we learned that many of them had grandparents, great-grandparents who were part of the genocidal exchange of populations in the 1920s in the fall of Smyrna. They were refugees from Asia Minor. Everyone seemed to have an immigrant story. They had married someone from outside Greece.
These are the aid workers you're talking about.
That's right. That's right. So there was a sense that we are all immigrants in one sense, and therefore this kind of work takes on a shared humanitarian motivation.
Just have one more question. I have known you for quite some time, and I know you're, as you said, Greek-American. You go to Greece quite often because of the refugee crisis. But I wonder what it was like for you to be in one of the cradles of modern medicine implementing a very different kind of Hippocratic Oath for a very different reason from what the original one was drawn up for. I mean, personally, what is this like for you?
It's an opportunity to take the expertise that I've learned here in the States and take it back to the origins of, you know, my family's migration in the 1950s. So my family left Greece after or during the civil unrest there after World War II, and to be able to go back and offer what I can. We were just there in September talking to folks in Salonika and Athens about the work that we do and recruiting help from the Greek psychiatric community. So being able to collaborate in this way has been both professionally and personally fulfilling.
Philip Candilis, thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
That's Dr. Philip Candilis, who's part of the George Washington Global Mental Health Program that's drawn up a Hippocratic Oath for humanitarian aid workers. Back to the U.S. now and a story from the American West. Walk through forests of that region and you're likely to see centuries-old pine and cedar trees that have had their bark peeled off in a special way. As KUNC's Raellen Bichel reports, archaeologists don't know why ancient tribes peeled some of the bark away, and they're running out of time to solve the mystery.
Cassandra Atencio says for tribes like the Southern Ute of Southwest Colorado, these ponderosa pines are as important as cliff dwellings or pictographs.
Because we were little and we were nomadic and we weren't like Pueblos and our Navajos. These trees show that we were here.
Atencio is a cultural representative for the Southern Ute Indian tribe. These special ponderosa pines are scattered across the Rocky Mountain region, and they all have something in common, a big chunk of bark missing from one side, peeled away by people sometime in the last few hundred years.
This is real. It places our footprint on the landscape as Ute people, as a tribe.
There are a bunch of them here, on the edge of a meadow south of the San Juan Mountains.
That is a humdinger right there.
Archaeologist Mark Mitchell walks up to a gnarled tree about as wide across as two people. Its thick red bark is curling in to reclaim an exposed area that looks a lot like a telephone pole.
We're looking at a place where, in the past, Native peoples have removed the outer bark.
He says they did it to get to a spongy white material inside, called phloem.
Some people describe it as a little astringent. I think it tastes kind of coconutty.
Mitchell is the research director for a nonprofit archaeology organization called the Paleocultural Research Group. They teamed up with the Forest Service to study trees like this one.
Okay.
Volunteers start taking measurements and photos. One person starts screwing a hollow pole into the tree, as thin as a drinking straw.
There we go.
The sample will give a date for when the peel happened.
Got it? Perfect.
There are a lot of questions about these peeled trees.
Yes, there are. One of the biggest questions we have is, what precisely was the purpose of the phloem? We know it's edible.
But, he says, were people eating it because it was a delicacy or because they were starving? Was it medicine or part of a special occasion? Julie Coleman wonders if these trees might reveal patterns about how tribes like the Ute were moving across the landscape. She's an archaeologist with the San Juan National Forest.
Yeah. This is a GPS unit. We get point plots on each tree, and then hopefully we'll see a pattern. And, you know, it might show trails and, you know, passageways.
But Mark Mitchell says they're running out of time to study the peeled trees.
We feel like the clock is ticking now. It's been ticking for a while, but we really feel the urgency of it now.
Drought could kill these trees, or an expanding beetle infestation could cripple them with a fungus called blue stain, or wildfires could erase them.
Some of the big fires that we've had in Colorado in the last 5 or 6 years have taken some of these trees. We know that.
But time could also get them. Some of these trees could be 500 years old, like this one.
Oh, wow. That is cool.
Wow. That is neat. That is amazing. I was hoping we would find one of these.
For this tree, people didn't just scrape off the edible part. They also pried off 6 planks of wood, presumably to build something, like a traditional cradle board to carry a baby in. That's what it reminded Cassandra Atencio of.
Oh, wow.
Seeing it brought her to tears.
Wow.
Just a couple years ago, she made a cradle board for her grandson.
And I wanted to do his cradle board old school.
She'd wanted to peel a ponderosa plank for the backboard, but didn't know how. But here was an example, right in front of her.
How long has it been since there's been a Ute woman standing here in this spot again? This is really special. And I feel really good.
For Here and Now, I'm Ray Ellen Bischel.
Ray's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau.
The second suspect in the poisoning of a former Russian spy in the UK has been identified. The Bellingcat investigative website says the man's name is Alexander Mishkin, a military doctor working for Russian intelligence. The same website last month named the first suspect as Colonel Anatoly Chepega. The two men are suspects in the poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in the English village of Salisbury in March. BBC Global Affairs correspondent Naomi Grimley is following this story. And Naomi, tell us more. Who is Alexander Mishkin?
Well, we know that he was born in a village in northern Russia in 1979. He then graduated from Russia's Military Medical Academy in St. Petersburg, where he specialized in deep underwater physiology, whatever that is. And we also know that in 2014, he was made a hero of the Russian Federation by President Putin for actions in Ukraine. And the allegation is also that he was recruited when he was a student by the GRU, which is the military intelligence wing, and that he was then an agent for them.
And do we know where is he now?
Well, of course, he appeared last month on Russian TV back in Russia alongside his co-accused suspect in the Salisbury case. And they both appeared on Russian TV and claimed that they'd only gone to Salisbury to look at the famous cathedral spire there. Now, obviously, that got laughed at, that particular version of events. And what's interesting about today and also what happened last week when the Dutch authorities released a load of information about the activities of the GRU is that it's really left that idea of them going just as tourists to Salisbury as a rather threadbare story.
We've been reporting on this story over several months now, and one of the remarkable things about it is that there were so many images of both of these men making their way from the airport to Salisbury. Of course, there is just an overwhelming number of CCTV cameras throughout the country there. Is it a surprise or is it considered a failure that if these were really Russian intelligence officers, that they were so easy in the end to be identified?
I think there is a surprise that they have been, that so much information has been found out in the last few weeks about them. And that, of course, raises questions about the standard of the GRU operation. If an outfit like Bellingcat, which is a group of investigative journalists, they say they have no help from intelligence services. They're just often using open sources. If they can look back on school yearbooks and discover where people lived and what their names were, and they in fact went to this guy's village in northern Russia to verify from school friends what he looked like, if they're able to identify them, then that does suggest that the secret state in Russia perhaps needs to step up the level of its secret operations if it wants to get away with this kind of thing.
And tell us more about Bellingcat and this group of journalists. Do they have any help from their colleagues in Russia?
They've been working working with a website called Russian Insider that has also been working on this case, and they've done some of the legwork, for example, going to the village of Loyga in northern Russia to talk to Mishkin's school friends and friends of his grandma. And they use things like social media. They have a sort of community of people who look at their website and contribute information. I have to say, though, there are some protesters earlier at Westminster who were accusing Bellingcat of being the stooges of Western intelligence services. And they argue that there's no way they could have just come across copies of this man's passport on the internet.
I guess the question is, now we have supposedly the identity of these two men. They're both safely ensconced in Russia, beyond the reach of the authorities in Britain. I mean, what now?
Well, I think that is the big problem for the British authorities. It's all very well to identify a suspect, but if that suspect is beyond your reach and if there's no chance of having them extradited from Russia, then it's very hard to sort of take the case further. It's worth remembering here that although this was an attempted assassination in the beginning, it did result in the death of someone else. Dawn Sturgis was a 44-year-old British woman who, 3 months after the attempted assassination, happened to come across the vial of the nerve agent Novichok.
The perfume bottle, right?
The perfume bottle. Yeah. And it's a very sad story, really, that her and her partner, for whatever reason, picked up this vial and started using it. And of course, sadly, she died. So I think the British authorities are incredibly annoyed that there's not much they can do in terms of law and order when it comes to this duo. That said, obviously, the diplomatic pressure is being kept up all the time. And we saw that last week when intelligence agencies in Holland and also in the United States revealed a bit more information about what they know the GRU has been up to recently.
The BBC's global affairs correspondent Naomi Grimley in London. Thank you for speaking with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.